Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
The following is a presentation of the Four Center podcast feed.
From the center of the galaxy, this is the Four Center podcast feed. I'm Ken Napsok.
And I'm Joseph Scrimshaw, and today we are going to be discussing Disney Gallery, The Mandalorian, Practical. A beautiful, beautiful episode of television.
Yes, this was the episode many of us were waiting, where it was not all Baby Yoda, the child, or as Bryce Dallas Howard kept exclaiming, baby! but it was predominantly, and it brought some needed joy during tough times. And Joseph, we would be remiss if we didn't discuss and address some of the things going on and part of the Four Center plan in reaction to it.
Yeah, so a couple just big picture things. We are decided to go on with recording the podcast because we know people need a break, no matter what level of stress of people who choose to listen. It, you know, maybe helps have a moment of joy. It certainly helps us have a moment of joy during stressful times. So we're going to keep recording. We're still figuring out exactly what level of advertising we're going to do, because I know for myself personally, it does bother me when the world is really in pain and chaos, and then it's like, listen to our podcast feels a little tone deaf to me. So we're going to figure out the exact right balance for that. And then we wanted to acknowledge that the world is definitely in pain and suffering on this episode. We're probably going to talk a little bit more about our own personal reactions and feelings and processing on the main show, because that's where we normally do talk about what's going on in our lives at the top of the show. So we'll save any bigger picture stuff for that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We are going to dive into The Mandalorian, but hey, The Mandalorian is part of Star Wars, and Star Wars is the story of compassion, empathy, hope, defending the peace and the justice in the galaxy. And those are all things that Star Wars has going for it, and that we believe, and we look outside our walls and see see a lot of that and being challenged, a lot of that being asked to grow, forced to grow, hopefully. And, you know, we just want you all to know in the Force Center audience, we hear you, we feel you. We are very proud that the Force Center community that Joseph, Jennifer, and myself started, but you all made, allows for people of all kinds of perspectives, backgrounds, orientations, genders, to come to the fandom table. And then we make room as best we can. We're not always perfect, I'm sure, but we make room for those who normally aren't invited to the table. That's because of all of you. And so we want to discuss Star Wars, including a behind the scenes show about a show. We want to discuss that with that spirit and acknowledge, yes, as Joseph said, the world is in pain. And you know what? Hey, the world's in pain and suffering every day, but it is highlighted right now and highlighted for good reasons. And it's all on our minds, and it's on our minds too. And we'll find the right way with your guys' blessings as a listener group to do those tweets. Because, yeah, sometimes, hey, it's business, listen to this podcast. But other times, as Joseph said, it's like offering a dessert while everyone is starving. And we're going to find the right way to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Well said. And I do really appreciate that our community is diverse and everybody is on board about having fun and thoughtful discussions about Star Wars. And that is one of the things that brings me great joy and why I get excited even in really difficult times to be able to do the podcast, to know that we have this community where being fun and thoughtful is valued.
It is. And so in that spirit, and with you out there listening, your blessings and hopefully your understanding, we'll go into this episode of Disney Gallery : The Mandalorian : Practical here on the 13th episode of The Mandalorian Report, The Adventures of Luke Starkiller. Here we go. All right. So, Joseph, we got to dive into this. After highlighting the amazing technological breakthroughs, the volume and all that stuff that goes into making The Mandalorian, this episode took us to the practical side, which we always known was there. In fact, we learned a lot last week that, hey, a lot more practical than we thought, a lot more VR than we thought. So I want to start there. How did you react to that in general, the choice to focus on the practical?
Oh, I was so excited for it. Everybody was waiting for it. In some ways, to me, it feels like the main event, because I think for a lot of people, when you hear you're going to get behind the scenes of The Mandalorian, and for a lot of people, The Mandalorian is the Baby Yoda show, then you're just waiting for that quality time with Baby Yoda and the practical realities behind the child, behind baby. But I did like that it was expanded beyond that. So it wasn't just about that. It was more the philosophy of practical, the value of practical. And as they highlight in this episode so many times, and we'll talk about the relationship between practical and more computer generated. And I really like now in retrospect that they did the groundbreaking volume stuff, which was really fascinating. And right, some of the philosophy and the vision behind computer generated stuff. So then it's a compliment to talk about the practical.
Yeah, you touched on something there, the philosophy of the practical. And we're going to get to something, a moment with Bryce Dallas Howard, where I literally kind of lit up and was like, she's speaking for me, and loved it. And how it is, these last two episodes have forced me to examine how I look, not how I watch and understand, but how I just look at the Star Wars visuals and where some of my preconceived notions take me, good and bad. And I've been enjoying that that aspect of these last two episodes, but this practical one in particular. So we're going to dive in with Rick Famuyiwa talking about Star Wars historically using great tech. And I keep saying I'm a fan of this guy, even though I sometimes stumble over his wonderful last name. His voice is so soothing to me. I want an ASMR channel of him just discussing Star Wars. I just love everything he says. I really do. It's been one of the benefits of this series is highlighting him, not a director, not a creator, but him for me. And he talks about historically Star Wars uses great tech, but it brings things down to a relatable human level. And he believes that is the mix, that mix is a balance, and we love that term, and balance, that in part in Star Wars, and that part, quote, makes Star Wars. I want to dive into that, Joseph. I want to dive into this idea. There's a lot of things that make Star Wars. We've discussed a lot of them. But in terms of the history of Star Wars and the technical advancements and technology that's come out of Star Wars, we all know that. We've discussed that mixed with the human level. How do you feel about this? Do you have any further thoughts on Rick's belief in that special kind of Star Wars balance?
Yeah. This was really great way to start the episode. I totally agree with you. I was thinking that this morning when I watched the episode for the second time. Not only do I love everything that Rick Famuyiwa has done on screen, but the content of what he says, but he's just got such a great energy. He really is like, could I just give you a menu for Depars and you could just read everything on it? Because there's a tone to his demeanor and his perspective that's just, you know, soothing. It really is. But in terms of the actual great content of what he said, it was yet another way to reflect on this theme that I really love in Star Wars, of that it's a cocktail of the new and the old, right? And that goes from everything from the storytelling, which we've talked about from the beginning of Luke looking to the future but wanting to be a Jedi because of his father, on and on. And that also goes to, well, A New Hope was looking back at fantasy and older Hollywood ideas, while also technologically moving things forward. It was great to think of that paradigm also being applied just to the actual technology, to say, here is, stop motion. Here is King Kong level tech. Here is a puppetry that's trying to be like 1980 in some ways with Yoda. But then also here is the volume, the absolute most cutting edge, in that spirit of new and old in the technology as well supports all of these other relationships between new and old that make Star Wars feel, I think, not only special and different, but also real.
Yeah, he really highlighted the reality, the feeling real. He talked about when I saw it, yeah, it was in space and this and that, but 8-year-old me was like, I can't wait to be in that world, right? Because he felt it was so real, and that's inspiring a lot of levels. And what you're saying too, this series, look, I think a lot of this stuff is also being accomplished in Rise of Skywalker, Solo, in all the movies. I really, you know, think of Tarkin, whether, you know, you're fully on board or not, just they pulled that off to some degree. Think of Solo and the natural lighting and Phoebe Waller-Bridge's L3 and all the new things. And then Rise of Skywalker, you and I were blown away, like, that was real quicksand in a way, you know? But yet the snake was real, but then I think it's being done in all parts of Star Wars, but this series going into it, Joseph, we kind of felt like this was going to be that. It was an advertisement for all the elements being in balance. And that makes sense now to hear Rick describe it in this way.
Yeah. And then I love that it also, he extended that to his experience of watching and creating Star Wars, that it, you know, what he was saying wasn't purely technical. That idea about that's what makes Star Wars relatable is that it feels real, which was really powerful for me to hear him say, because that's what I've always loved about Chapter 2, which talked about in our review, and I think when I did on Collider, it starts to blur together. But I love Chapter 2 because it is the most outrageous thing, right? It is this armored warrior who has to fight all these little scavengers, and he gets attacked by a beast, and he's saved by a Muppet who uses the Force. There's nothing about that on the surface that says, yeah, that's my day, but it feels like my day. It feels like the worst days of my life when I get up and I just need to get to work and send one email and I can't find my pants and I lose my keys and there's a traffic accident that I'm stuck in and then the damn printer doesn't work. And it feels like that. And to know that that is flowing from his desire to actually create that, it makes me feel great to feel like you totally intended what I received.
Yeah. First of all, I am laughing at the image of you walking into a room looking for your pants and having Ludwig Göransson score behind you. You know,
where are those Spurs sounds coming from? I don't even have pants.
All well said. And this kind of all dovetails into Taika Waititi coming on there. And again, talking about another person who's just fun to listen to for different reasons. He's soothing too. I'll give him credit for that, but he's fun. He's so lively. He's so animated. Even when he's just describing this, he talked about how they're going back to New Hope, which all these directors seem to be doing often, and which makes sense with the series, how the scuffs and damage on the droids, R2 and 3PO, New Hope, immediately told him and us as fans that there was a history there. And it seems so simple, Joseph, but to go back to 77, because for us, it is what it is. But to go back to 77, that's overlooked. Yes, that's what George was saying. There's a great story here you don't know. And I call this tip of the iceberg production design and stuff. So I'm rambling here, but did the Mando succeed in creating new histories while playing around in familiar places? And what do you feel about those droid dents?
Yeah, no, I love the droid dents, right? Because there's been lots of talk about, like, it's a used universe, so it makes you feel mm-hmm. more lived in. But I love this particular perspective of, like, it even happens in story when Luke's like, you got a lot of carbon scoring. Have you seen many battles, you know? And it immediately goes like, ooh, what else have they been involved in? And I feel like in Mandalorian, there is a very concerted effort to recreate that vibe. In the design, but also in the storytelling. Like we talked about it, there were some fans who were like, why are we going back to Tatooine? Been there, done that. But I want to know what happened to Chalmers Cantina. You know, is it just that the huts collapsed? Did Wuher actually get killed by a robot? Is that a droid? Is that why a droid is working the bar at Chalmers Cantina?
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
As you say, just the introduction of the guild itself, and we learned some of their rules. But not all of them, right?
Right.
And not in its entire history, at least in modern canon. So you get to wonder about that. This group of Mandalorians are always helmeted. And mm-hmm. that doesn't agree with other things we've heard. That's tip of the iceberg, right?
Yeah.
We learn and get to see more about Tusken and Jawa society. And that's tip of the iceberg because that makes you go, well, okay, if the Tuskens have this perspective in that chapter, what were they thinking all these other times we've seen them?
Right. Yeah, that's part of the power of what I think some of the best moments in Mando have done. Even, you know, you mentioned the Tusken Raider scene. I don't like episode 5 that much. I struggle with it. I still do for a lot of various reasons. But there's a lot of great in there. And that's so Star Wars, by the way, right? I don't really like the prequels. I do like that one scene. The Tusken Raider scene is damn good, and it's really important, and it's really interesting because it does make you go back and think on even some of the words being used by other characters in the other movies about them.
Yeah.
And that's part of what Mando did. It took all these things we knew and then just said, here's a different way to look at them, or here's more questions to ask about them. And that just became really fun, you know, really
yeah.
fun.
Yeah. Did there other moments of tip of the iceberg design or storytelling that fired your imagination that made you want to hear the rest of that story or just imagine the rest of that story?
I'll tell you the opening. And the opening of the show is really great. It's serves its purpose. It's such a, you know, cowboy walks into bar, problems, arrest. It's great exposition. You know, Horatio Sands, his voice. I love Horatio Sands, by the way, but, you know, and I'm so happy he's that character, but you know, it was Horatio Sands' voice after a second. You're like, who is, oh, I wish Christmas is here today. but it's great to get out to exposition, but I got to tell you, and the times that I've rewatched it, particularly this last time, like a couple weeks ago, I was rewatching the series. I get lost in how that works. When did they set that village up or that city up on a, on an ice area where monsters are coming out, and why? And why couldn't they move? And how many times has the Brian Posehn character almost been eaten before? And he gets eaten on the job here, like all these kind of things. So, yeah, that's right from the start. They did a great job of just going, here's where we're at. There's other stuff here. We'll leave you to wonder.
Yeah, yeah. And that goes back to like great things that Lucas has said about sociology of like he wants to figure out why different societies live where they do and how is that going to affect how they behave or their perception of reality. And, you know, coming from Minnesota, where, you know, people do go ice fishing on frozen lakes, or, you know, there's a big art event that people build little art shanties and have events on, like, did it start out of need or did it start out of just like, we want to explore what it's like to live on a frozen lake? Maybe we shouldn't when there are monsters underneath it.
Or yeah, you're so not desperate, but interested and keen to live on the fringes of this new republic or the old republic and the empire before it, that you chose to build your shanty above a sea monster and risk it. Is that was better, or that's better for you?
Yeah.
Getting choices to the, you know, we always talk about the state of the galaxy and we need a little more state of the galaxy and Force Awakens. I could take a beat or two more for sure. But this does stuff like this really gives you that state of the galaxy.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, stop me if you've heard this before. Joseph Grimshaw, who has said this many times before and others, but here on Force Center, you, but Jon Favreau talked about he and Filoni often joking that this whole series was about playing with their Star Wars toys. He went on to talk about giving D-list Star Wars characters a story. Why do we feel this type of nostalgia worked? And I want to be honest here, a little more well-received than in other Star Wars storytelling, which at times I find that unfair, but it was, I can't deny, a little more well-received. So I'm dumping a lot of questions out of my toy box in front of you. But Joseph, first of all, what was your reaction when you literally heard Favreau say what has been said so many times before? And then you grab your TIE fighter, and then you grab your bounty hunter, and you play.
Yeah, I mean, he literally said you grab your Boba Fett action figure and your Jawas action figures, and you make them fight. I think it was gratifying to hear that. I did that BBC interview the night that Mandalorian was going to premiere, I believe. And I laid that out of like, he's really Favreau and Filoni are really people of that generation who played with those action figures and imagined what it would be like if they had other adventures. So that's really going to be the spirit of it. And I believe the BBC correspondent was just like, yeah, but don't you think we have too much Star Wars? So it was nice to hear it after I have received some cold responses to that theory.
Yeah. And it just, yeah, sorry. I mean, it was said a lot. I mean, you were, I know it's been said and written in a lot of places. I get it. It's not this super giant insightful leap, but it was something you said first to me that never left me. You said in celebration off air as we are going around collecting our toys. And so it stuck with me, but I just had a big laugh and I turned to Grace and I go, Joseph has been saying that for years. Well, great moment for me, just outside of the big stuff there.
Yeah.
To the other question, maybe this is just me. I just feel there's a lot of, we've talked about a lot of nostalgia, which isn't a bad word to me. A lot of these connections, new histories with old things we're familiar with. And in Mandalorian, it was celebrated a little bit more than the other movies. And I'm not saying the other movies or shows did it all perfectly. I am not. But am I off base there, or is it just because I'm wrapped up in the Mando right now? Help me, Joseph. Help me, Obi-Wan, Joseph.
No, I don't think you're off base at all. And I think I don't want to come off too much about like I'm happy because I was right. Lots of people have said that, as you said. I think that the action figure thing is exciting to me because I lived that experience of wanting more stories and developing these relationships with these characters that you had in molded plastic. And that really fulfilling the tip of the iceberg storytelling, which was that desire to go, I want to live in that galaxy more. So what might this minor character do? What if he or she or they interacted with this other character that they don't interact with in the movie? And I think that spirit of discovery of we want to take something we already know and have it interact and do new things. And I think that's why the nostalgia doesn't feel a ton like nostalgia. Mm. Because it's all like Favreau goes on to say about these aren't just Ugnaughts. This is an Ugnaught with a character and a perspective. Right. And to contrast that with something that gets like critiqued a lot, which doesn't bother me, but Dr. Evazin and Ponda Baba in Rogue One.
Yeah.
It's just a little beat that's thrown in there because Gareth Edwards loved them. It's not a big thing. But as a contrast, Dr. Evazin does the exact same thing, basically. He almost starts a fight with our young hero for zero real reason, right? So it's just, it's that guy doing the thing he does. Whereas, you know, if part of the storytelling of Rogue One was we actually went into Dr. Evazan's, you know, horrific medical theater and saw him doing something, I think there would be more excitement because it's taking this character, this little fact we know about him, and then going somewhere new with it. And I think that's the thing about Mandalorian that is making people forgive anything that feels like nostalgia, because it's not just nostalgia.
I think that, yeah, that's really good. That actually helps me a lot to understand, because I'll admit I always get a little defensive on some of the other things. But like it, all of it really worked for Solo in me, if for me in Solo, I should say. Let me get the words right in my sentence. You know, Solo had that, we didn't need that and everything. And that might be because of what you're saying. There might have been one or too many winks and nods to something you already know, where I feel like they are giving you a lot of new insight into Han Solo as a character, as a person, as a man in that world. I think there's some great things there. But, you know, I understand now, especially a year or two removed, what you're saying is sometimes it does feel like a wink and a nod, where Mando doesn't all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that maybe there is something even at another level where he says the D-list characters. But I think it's powerful for, we've spent a lot of times with, certainly a ton of our characters are underdogs like Han Solo. But, you know, by the time of the sequel trilogy, they've literally become legends. They're, you know, legendary smugglers and war heroes. And we have, you know, all of these Jedi with amazing powers and therefore amazing responsibilities. And the prequel series is literally the people who have the power in the galaxy, the government and the Jedi and the queens and the senators. Mandalorian is not just we're not spending time with the main characters. It's spending time with the people who don't have actual power in the galaxy, for the most part, who are just trying to get by. And characters that we've seen before, like Ugnaughts and Jawas and Tuskens, in showing them having an internal life and a perspective and desires and needs. And those are characters that before we've either seen as just antagonists to the heroes or just servants of the heroes. So it, not only is it a new perspective, it is a perspective that is giving validity to the value of every character that you see in Star Wars.
This is my new t-shirt. Well said. And I love all of you Force Center fans who support our repeated phrases, nervous tics, or filler words, and make them into fun games. that's well said is my thing, just because we do a lot of insight sharing on these programs. Just got me thinking, this is not, and I want to carry on the discussion that we have planned here today, but if this had been what Favreau originally wanted, a Boba Fett series, and yes, we understand Mr. Fett might be roaming on into the story real soon, and perhaps already did. If it was a Boba Fett the series, would it have worked the same? Because I think there's some benefit of it's the Mandalorian who we don't know, so therefore it's kind of doing what you've been talking about here, something new wrapped up in something old, and it's on the side. But if it was Boba Fett, we would have been like, does that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think the beginning of the show probably would have had to work to break him down, to show you that he is not in this place of kind of power and respect and fear that he was. That he was, he was a criminal and bounty hunter. He's on the fringes of society, but he's absolutely at the top of the fringes of society. You know, I read that bounty hunter war trilogy back in the day, is one of the Legends series expanded universe that I read. In those, Boba Fett is Sherlock Holmes mixed up with, you know, martial artist. Like he can do no wrong. You know, he has thought 8 miles, million parsecs ahead of everyone. And I think there would have had to be some work to downgrade him from legend status back to what his father Django says, a simple man trying to get by in the universe.
And they might have a chance to do that in season two. In this conversation, this show is put together so well where it just naturally spins off into the next subject. They're the king of like radio transitions, this documentary series here. kind of. Because from Favre talking about D-lists and Ugnaughts and Empire, we go into one of our favorite characters, Joseph Queel. Or Queel, Keewheel. It's still said differently every time, like a Star Wars character. I love this sequence because, first and foremost, Misty Rosas got some very due attention for her work as Queel. As we knew, she was on set and in the costume, but this was new to me. The process had many parts to it. One, her performance, the animatronics of that mask that she wore, and then Nick Nolte's VO already recorded and playing over the set. I didn't know that. I could not even have imagined that. How do you feel about this revelation? And how much, I got to say, this is a leading question. How much do we just love her physicality in performing this character?
She was so great. Queel was one of those characters that I absolutely loved. And I kind of just let my mind go about the how. Like, there was moments where, like, I'm pretty sure that's a person in a costume. There are other moments where, like, I'm pretty sure that's an animatronic mouth. The other moments, like, is that CGI? Like, what's is that? Is Nick Nolte's face involved in this in any way? Like, I enjoyed the mystery, and now I enjoyed the mystery being solved. She did a phenomenal job. And this came up with Queel and comes up later with Baby, about just this great spirit of teamwork of we're really, you know, I think it's what's exciting to me about it is it's a part of the Star Wars lore that I value of flowing, organic, intuitive teamwork, and that idea of we all hear the emotion in one of the 2 to 3 takes that Nick Nolte recorded.
Yeah.
And we're going with this one, and you over there kind of know that I'm going to want to lift my head up, and so my eyes should furrow at that point, you know? And just being in touch with one another is, it's just, it's exciting and beautiful.
It's fascinating. This is one of those little moments where I suddenly share something I'd learned and kept secret and everything. Before Nick Nolte was announced for the series, a friend of mine had said, Nolte's walking around the office today.
Did anybody let him in, or is he?
Yeah, right. And this is the LA, probably on Favre's side of things than Lucasfilm. I don't know those details. I don't know. They're like, he's walking around. I think what he's going to be doing in the series, because it had already been rumored, I think it's going to be VO related and everything like that. So now seeing this and seeing that it was already recorded at some point, and maybe he did a final, you know, pass, comes back in, I cannot help but think, because I love I think he's great. The voice is great. It's perfect. I can't help think of him as Krusty the Clown in that famous Simpsons clip of just walking. Let me show you how to do it, kid. Get out. It just, the fact that she's like, well, he gave us like 2 or 3 reads. It's like, he probably came in on a Friday and was like, all right, I'll record some stuff. Yeah. But it all worked. It's all hilarious. And it all worked to me.
I know that I have spoken was a beautifully written line of dialogue that was intended, but in my headcanon, I want it to be that Nick Nolte read all of his other lines and then just said, I have spoken, and left. And then they're like, we can use that several times.
Oh, it's great. But anyways, just again, hats off or Queel mask off to Misty Rosas. I really think she is did a great job. It's just especially if you go back and watch the series now getting a little more recognition of her. You can see it. You can see her choices, and I really loved it. So it's a character you and I love, and I love, like you said, teamwork in making that character pop.
Yeah.
Final moment here, then we'll take a quick break. And on the other side, yeah, the main event. But this was a moment for me. Bryce Dallas Howard, who, again, I enjoy that Howard family. I want to go to the Howard family picnic there. Bryce Dallas Howard expressed what many of us, and that's my notes, but really me, sometimes worry about all this new tech and all these art forms could possibly potentially erase some of the things we all love about traditional practical effects. Now, as we all know, Phantom Menace had so many practical effects, but it was sold as part of a new era of digital filmmaking and CGI and all those kind of things, and we can get lost in that there. I don't want everything. I want everything to look better. I grew up in the 80s, and now when I go back watch some of those movies that I loved, I'm like, oh God, that looked bad. You know, so I'm all for it getting better. But yeah, there's a spirit to it in conjunction and connected to a lot of things we were talking about in this episode already about the reality, the histories, the lived in feel. And that's kind of the crux of this whole episode to me was what Bryce Dallas Howard was talking about. And she was, and this is someone who not only just grew up in filmmaking, but has been an actor and been in big budget productions and pictures. So she knows how it can go right and knows how it can go wrong. So I don't know. I loved her being honest about that question as a director and going, all right, it worked. And we discussed this a little bit last week because of the volume wasn't, it had more practical elements to it than maybe as advertised or what we thought, at least I thought. So why do you feel this still matters to us? Is it just generational? We grew up in a different time. Do we want Ray Harryhausen, you know, stop motion up there? What are we reacting to? What do you think?
I think, like, not to criticize CGI, because obviously there can be great advancements. We talked about that all last week, which is why I'm glad that they did that episode. There's so many things about the volume, including like the lighting and making it more real for the actors. That's great. So I don't mean any of this is everything should be practical. But I do think that there is something to an object in front of you being real, that it is tactile, that it can be literally touched, and you can, even if you can't perceive that, even if you went through and you could fail the test on saying, is that desk in the client's office real or is it on the screen? Even if you could fail that test, it still matters sometimes, I think, to the actors, and particularly with something like Queel or something like Baby, where people are having a true emotional reaction to a real physical object. I think that is valuable to mix with the CGI and all the computer advancements. I think there's also just something, and Filoni, I think, touches on this in his epic closing speech part two in this episode, that it goes along with Star Wars. In Rick Famuyiwa, I believe, was saying this at the top too, of like, that's this marriage of the old and new is part of what makes it different than other, makes Star Wars different than other big budget things. Right. And I think, again, it's that marriage of the themes in the story with the approach in reality, this idea that the past matters and that there's power in the old ways as well as the new. And it's a weird line to draw, but you can draw a line, as Filoni said, from the child being practical to, hey, when Kylo Ren says, kill the past, that's the bad guy. And the message of the movie is that's not right. You shouldn't just erase everything. You should take the value from the past and find a way to move forward. And it's literally like the production of The Mandalorian, to me, is following my interpretation of the lesson of the sequel trilogy of take what is valuable from the past.
Yeah,
make it your own and move into the future.
I think that's so true. I will avoid saying well said, but then I said it. it's so true, because that might be what I'm reacting to. Because I, and even this series more than when I watched the actual show, The Mandalorian, I had, and I still, it's on audio. I can't go back. There's some things I didn't connect with as much because I felt, again, this is my own kind of hang up on, that looks like it was a spaceship on a Commodore 64. I can't get into this and everything. That's not even Pedro Pascal. And I can let that pull me down some path. Not that some of that, those thoughts aren't right to have, but I think I was so relieved to see, oh no, they had it the whole time. And I wasn't seeing it. And to see the relief and joy, not relief, but just joy on Bryce Dallas Howard's face of like, I had this worry, but that wasn't the worry. And then combining what you're talking about, Joseph, is the past fuels the future, the present. We must learn from it, grow from it, take what's valuable and change it. All those kind of big philosophical things are present in the making of this, of all of Star Wars to me right now, but Mandalorian. And Filoni talks a little bit about that at the end. We'll get back to that. But yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe that's what I'm reacting to, both in the past and now. And it all makes sense because it all is ties to Kylo Ren, is what you're saying.
Yes, I'm saying 1,000 generations live inside Baby.
Absolutely. In a way, that is very, very true. All right, we are going to take a quick break, reset. And on the other side, that's right, it's Baby Yoda time. Stick around for more Mandalorian Report here on Force Center.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, 4Center fans, don't forget 4Center is on YouTube. Head over there to catch up with our new show, Star Wars Show and Tell. Joseph, Jennifer, Ken, and special guests sit down and share favorite items from their own Star Wars memorabilia collections. Plus, there's the In Memoriam video series, encore presentations of Databank Brawl, and special programming all there for you, and more shows on the way. It's 4Center on YouTube. Check it out. Welcome back to The Mandalorian Report, episode 13 of our show, looking at episode 5 of the behind-the-scenes show that focused on the 8-episode Mandalorian show. Get it? All right. It's all there. It is like the infinite improbability drive from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Sorry. I'm reading a lot of Hitchhikers lately.
As long as our podcast doesn't turn into a whale, I'm good.
Our bowl of petunias. Oh, no, not again. Here we go. This is it. The main event. Baby Yoda time. But don't call it Baby Yoda. Call it the child or just call it Baby. All right. A lot of again, Bryce Dallas Howard, a superstar of just like casually drops in, you know, and then with Baby and then that shot of her on set. Her who, you know, she's a mother herself, you know, she's in tune to their children, the child performers on set, just like, what do you think about Baby? I was like, I like it. So good. Good moment.
It really, after waiting to hear them talk about the child, talk about Baby Yoda, to just see and hear her glee and that turn of phrase to have her like, I don't even know how to talk about baby. And then a couple seconds later, she says, you know, and then with computer and like, she just hates the. And it's really charming.
Well, get rid of those does. So a lot to talk about in the scene, and just we certainly might jump around because there were some repeated beats and discussions because everyone wanted to talk about it, and I want to start here. Werner Herzog, oh my God, we got not enough of him at all. We got the story, oh my God, the Deborah Chow story of him addressing the child as if it was real is amazing. But I want to talk here. His zest for the child to me is not just infectious, it is, but it ties into a reason this worked. The stuff we've been talking about here, that the new tech allowed for, as he said, fantasy to have no bounds. It was almost like we were enraptured each week by the fact that we couldn't tell what was real and what wasn't, and so we just simply chose to believe in the magic. Why did this work more for this character than any other character in the history of the world, Joseph?
Yeah, man, so grateful for those comments from Werner. You know, heartbreakingly beautiful. It can move around in there. All the great things he said. You know, they talk about it a little bit more later. The people who actually designed the puppet, ultimately, talk about, like, sometimes there's just a little bit of extra spark. And I think that's what's really exciting about it, because there's lots to break down. There's lots to discuss and analyze. And obviously, we're going to do that with the pictures and the narrative and the choices and the direction. But that's what's really exciting about it, is there's just an extra spark, right? Just everything came together in a way where that little guy, baby, is just full of life and just so totally believable. And then what's done with that puppet that's so believable is so powerful, to just feel like that it exudes the essence of a creature that is new to the world. And I know baby is 50 years old, but baby through those big eyes is taking the world in. And he gets mad. He gets happy. He wants his Mando daddy sometimes. And he's so relatable, but it wouldn't come across unless all of these elements had come together to create something that's more than the sum of its parts. That's just like the you know, it's almost the, you know, the puppet is not this crude matter. It's a luminous being.
Well, and it's you're talking about the teamwork and the spirit of Star Wars and a lot of people coming together and realizing they need to work together for one goal. It's all there. It's all present. And it does just have that touch of magic. And the reason, you know, Werner Herzog's just moments and the words he chooses to describe it. And he's just such an interesting person himself that we get. But you got Taika Waititi and Gina Carano. We've seen the clip of Carl Weathers even in story. Just got, this is the child that's got. It is that touch of magic, man. And because the way they went about creating this character, the technical stuff behind it, the fact that it could be shot as a real character with real lighting and even in choosing not to go with too many CGI versions of it, but limiting those versions of the child to what the puppet can do, I thought was just one of those little tiny strokes of genius that made all of it work, you know?
Yeah. And leaning into like his little waddle, you know, and I think that is going from, I remember early with the prequels where they're talking about making CGI Yoda and saying, you got to make his ears wobble, because in 1980, the puppet's ears wobbled and it gave him personality and life. And the fact that even I think moments where we might be seeing a CGI child, he's got that waddle that he does because he's a puppet.
Yeah, oh God, that waddle. What is that? When he returns, it's not episode 4, right? It's when they return to pick up Cara Dune, that his walking like his dad. It's still one of my favorite moments in the show. Guys. Yeah. And we're gonna come to the other designs here. I want to jump ahead a little bit to Pedro Pascal. who did have some moments with the child on set there, talking about how the child activates your primal childhood dreams. I love that. I love that. This is to me, I believe this is the magic elixir, right, Joseph? This is the ultimate what if. What if Yoda was a kid, and how would it work, and what would you do? It's got to be some of the reasons this worked.
Yeah, I think so. I think it taps into something that I think Yoda has a little bit when we meet him in Empire of he's relatable to kids because he's this little weirdo that people don't actually believe in or realize actually has, you know, perspective and power. But I think it's it's different here, obviously, because baby is a baby, and it's so pure the way he's taking in the world. He's just observing. He's hungry. He sees that one person plays with that, so he'll play with that. That's shiny. Oh, he sees he gets a reaction from the Mando Daddy when he flicks that, so he'll flick that. He sees violence, so he does violence. He's so incredibly relatable to just being young, but also to just kind of be in a state in the world where you're not making rational, not rational, you're not going through like logic making, and you're not burdened too much by emotions and experiences. You're just reacting intuitively to the world. So that's all relatable to the just great, beautiful baby just staring at stuff and reacting. But then you add on to that the fantasy of power. On top of all of that, he actually does have power, and he can do the things that sometimes we wish we could of, you know, we talked about chapter 2 being relatable of Mandalorian just trying to get through his crappy day. And here he is about to just be smashed and, you know, probably killed, and baby can just lift his hand and make it stop. And there's the fantasy of power that goes along with how relatable he is just the cutest damn child ever.
And he's so pure. I think one of my low-key favorite moments is him healing Grief Karga, including the he's trying to eat me. But just the fact that the child has no prejudices, no preconceived notions, no anything. Just was like not even fully aware that Grief Karga might have been trying to hurt him before or was part of it. Just is like, person hurts, I have the power to heal. It's pretty powerful, part of the Star Wars statement. And so to see it just all play out so realistically, again, talking about how they made it, the magic, it is magic. It is really amazing how, because to me, we've talked about it when reviewing the show. It wasn't just that cool character, really cute. It's a meme now. It really hit for big, deep reasons. And it was nice to see.
Yeah.
I don't mean this negatively. I don't mean this as a challenge question. I honestly am asking, how do you think they can capture that magic again in season 2? We're already aware of it. We know the character's there. We don't want adolescent Yoda. Any thoughts on what they could do to keep that magic going?
I think they have to let the magic evolve. And I'm really curious to see what they're going to do with the aging, right? I mean, and not to go into like canon weeds, but you know, we get questions from people of like, yeah, there's a little bit of a timeline with the species that you don't have to agree with or disagree with, but Yoda allegedly, if we are to believe Yoda is his own a reliable narrator of his life, that he was teaching by 100. Yeah. So you know, baby's got some growing up to do. So there's that hanging over the storytelling of, is this going to be a coming of age story? But even if it isn't, I feel like we're still going to get some of those beats of magic of the child watching what is happening around him, taking it in. And I guess to answer your question more directly,
sure.
I think one of the things that was successful in the first season is we didn't see too many repeated beats. When we think of our favorite moments, they were almost all twists and escalations, right? We see him stop the Mudhorn. There's that one great moment where he's going to reach out to use the Force and he looks at his hand because he isn't sure if he did it or not. then it evolves to that very purposeful, I'll stop the flames at the end and flick him away. We get the dark side moment where he doesn't understand that that Daddy Mando is not actually being hurt and chokes Cara Dune, right?
Yeah.
So everything is unique, and I think that's key to keeping the magic alive, to seeing new iterations of things that we know are within the capability of the character. But I think also, I go to that choking Cara Dune moment of, if this is going to be at least partially a story about the Mandalorian finding where this child belongs, it's also going to be about the child starting to be truly affected and formed by the world, and not have these choices be one-off things, but have to be like, season one, Mando accepted that he's going to be a parent for now. And I think season two might be a little bit, okay, well, what kind of parenting does Mando do then? Does he, you know, make sure that baby's looking away when he has to be violent, you know? Or does he, you know, try to teach a baby about when to be violent? All those kind of questions.
And this all leads up to the moment we're not factoring in yet. Much like Maggie Simpson's first words spoken by Elizabeth Taylor, we're going to hear his first word at one point, right?
That is right. It'll be McClunky.
McClunky. And then we'll get the definition. Maybe McClunky is actually the species. And Greedo was just like randomly shouting out some facts for Han Solo.
That's right. He's doing some Star Wars trivia.
Final thing here. All right. We've seen some of these concept ones before, but they highlighted the other Baby Yoda designs and the key to get to, you know, Favreau's right, man. We knew what we had to start with. I had worked on some stuff before. I loved hearing that thought process. And then the winning design comes in, and it's tough to not look at, You know, from looking back, you go, well, yeah, clearly that was what Darth Vader should have looked like that you look now. Did you have any other designs that, you know, you kind of liked?
Oh, my God. The ugly one. I love the thought process of, well, let's try him if he's kind of really traditionally cute, like kind of almost lean into, you know, Hello Kitty kind of style of cute. Let's go real hard the other way. that image, he looks not only like Don Rickles, but like a part of Don Rickles' body that I don't need to see. Like there's a magic to how, like, just gross he looks.
Oh God, sorry. That got me. Oh, yeah. I went for the ugly one, too, because there were some other. The ugly one, it just was the hair, the little stringy hair just all everywhere.
Yeah.
It looked like, because what we ended up with, it's definitely more of a child design to me. The other one was like, someone was like, how old is it? It's 50. Okay, let me draw a 50-year-old. And I'm like, I mean, you're not wrong.
Yeah, it's almost like this Benjamin Button idea of like, well, that's actually what Yoda looked like when he was young. So we're going to start real old.
Oh, that's a win. Oh, that makes me laugh. That's great. Any other final thoughts here, Joseph, on the Baby Yoda discussion before we move on?
Wanted to take a second because it did flow past pretty quickly. Just shout out to Chris Alsman, who is the one who did that final design. And knowing that he's the one who added that little coat, myself and many, many other people, it's not unique, have made the IKEA monkey comparison.
Yeah.
And I would love to know sometime from Chris Alsman if that was conscious, because I think that is a huge part of the magic of the character, of looking like they're wrapped up in something that is a little too adult for them and are like, you're not an adult yet, but you're kind of dressed like you're going out for dinner, you know, at a, you know, in a snowy restaurant in Russia, maybe. I don't know. There's just something about that jacket that looks like sort of, I'm bundled up to go out and be a person, but I don't know how to be a person yet.
Oh, it's like me in seventh grade. It's great. I love it. Yeah. Chris Alsman, that's a great call. Forgot to write that one down. Yeah, just give me a book of Baby Yoda art. I'll be all right. Next on, they did another smooth transition into IG-11. Hal Hickel, the animation supervisor, talked about the decision. And again, he worked on Rogue One. He said, to take advantage of IG-11's design and not having to be actor/human-driven, I'll start there. In retrospect, was that a choice we liked, especially, you know, we're part of the generation of fans, Joseph, that they even mentioned on the show, Filoni mentioned kind of directly, of we spent generations idolized and looking up to and join IG 11 or IG 88. And he never moved, really. And even Dave mentioned legends and video games. I think Favre said too, but really he didn't move. He was pinned to that Star Destroyer bridge. So in retrospect, do you like this decision here to go to non-human driven?
Yeah, I love the idea. I love the story that, hey, there was this kind of awkward model, a maquette, and that inspired the way he was going to move in the CGI version. I really like it because it's just leaning into IG-88 is one of those characters who looks cool, but also just kind of weird. And you go like, well, we've been told he's a badass bounty hunter, but he's just this weird rod. How does he go about being badass? And I love that they leaned into, well, that's the way he looks. How could he move that would be badass? So instead of, you know, sort of retconning and realizing like, oh, all these limbs come out or he, you know, whatever. I love that they just gave a why to how he moves based on how he looks and how we've all thought about it for years.
Yeah, Hal Hickel describing like the kind of the angles and the structure of the design that's been present for years and how they decided to kind of incorporate that. And even I think I might be misremembering some of it, but just how even how some of those models or maquettes moved were kind of janky. They're like, well, that's it. Let's kind of build on that. That worked for me because in that first episode, I had that reaction watching at home the very first time going, oh, okay. So that's how.
Right? Yeah, the spinning.
Yeah. And I know I played Shadows of the Empire. I know IG-88's part of the second Death Star in his brain. I get it. I get all that stuff. For me, someone who didn't live and breathe the legends as much as others, that was my response. So to me, I really, in retrospect, loved that decision. It was something different and it was something bold, but something familiar. Hey, kind of one of the themes here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a triumph.
A triumph indeed. John Favreau goes on to talk about needing to reference George's world once again, understandably, but every episode goes into George Lucas and something about the past a lot. I don't have any agenda behind that. I actually so enjoy it. But this was this episode's moment here. Favreau talked about needing to reference George's world, which means kind of keeping the essence of the world he created, honoring it, playing around in that world, but said there's fun to be had on the margins of this saga. And then he cites the holiday special, which he has cited before, and the Ewok TV shows, the movies, the main events. Rapid fire questions here, Joseph, when we dive into this part of the discussion. Do we feel like this show is truly in the margins? Do we as fans make it bigger? Like it's in the margins, but we're like, no, it's everything. And it's part of this larger story. Or do we just want it to be bigger, thus creating the expectations that it won't be fair going forward to the show. You know what I mean? If Favre's like, we just like our little margins and we're like, no, connect it to Rebels. is that going to hurt it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, these are great questions, Ken. There's so much there. I think there's that meta world of, yeah, if things keep coming out and people keep loving Mandalorian and that's like the thing that really the vast majority of fans are all on board with, then, yeah, regardless of what the story is, it's going to take on sort of a legend that is larger than life. Even if the characters don't have a huge impact on the galaxy, it's going to have a huge impact on how we think and react to Star Wars for sure. I think that playing with the margins idea that he's talking about is, yeah, definitely having a spirit of fun, having parts of Star Wars where you don't take it too sacred, which we're seeing. I think he is clearly, I think Favreau is clearly pushing back on the like, yeah, 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 I know we've said that about Mandalorians, but I want to tell this story and I want there to be room for it. So I think he's already pushing back a little bit on even kind of some bigger canon stuff, as well as saying, let's shine a light on the D-list characters and make up some new canon and have some fun and some absurdity. There's all that. But I also feel like, I guess, we are playing in the margins. But when the very first episode of the show is a Mandalorian discovering an infant that is the same species as Yoda and Yaddle, that's immediately touching on a huge part of Star Wars. Right. Yeah, I mean, the baby is just the baby right now, but that was one of my first reactions of, oh, we're going to do this. And yet to see exactly how they're going to do it. But George created this tip of the iceberg storytelling and then for himself decided he wanted to give a lot of answers in the prequels. But that species and the mystery of it
has been one of the untouched things of Star Wars, one of the unanswered questions forever. So to me, it's only in the margin so much when it starts the first episode with one of the holy grails of unanswered Star Wars questions.
Mm. Ooh, yeah, that's good food for thought, because I'm taking what you just said and maybe applying it already to something I don't know much of, which is season two and all these rumors. We're not even going to need to, we don't need to even go to the rumors, but rumors of bigger characters, characters that aren't in the margins anymore. They might have been at one point, but they're big in the minds of a lot of people, or someone like maybe Boba Fett that is very in the spotlight despite being in the margins of the original trilogy. And that might give fear. I know a lot of people, like I say, our friend of show, Hello Greedo, who generally we always kind of come to the same decisions about Star Wars. We take different paths or have different focuses and interests and reactions to a lot of things. But he's kind of been like I don't want this to be anything I know. He, without saying it directly, I'm not quoting him, just saying like, hey, I want it to be in the margins. But what you're telling me is one of the things is like it sells that it's in the margins because it is in the margins, but it's not afraid to deal with the big things and the big questions or bigger characters in the right way. And that gives me some faith that if they're going to spin this story into a little bit more of bigger characters or plot points, they're still going to know how to handle it. That's something I kind of need to hear, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's in a way, I'm trying to think the right way to say this. I think the philosophy that I saw in the first season that I am totally guessing is going to be the philosophy of the second season of, we're still doing tip of the iceberg storytelling in our show. Every once in a while, you guys are going to know the rest of the iceberg. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think that at any point Moff Gideon is going to have an expositional scene that fills everybody in on the Darksaber. It's just going to be, if you know it, you know it. And I think the story is going to remain focused on the characters that we know. So I think even if every character who's been rumored announced, hey, if there's some CGI youth and Luke Skywalker shows up, I think the story is still going to stay focused on this clan of two as the main characters.
Yeah. There you go. I'm on board for that. And then just imagine him off Gideon. This is the Darksaber. It is. Though he gives one of those kind of speeches. So who knows? Maybe I haven't. But no, I agree with you. I think it's just going to be there. So we'll see. This is the big questions to ask going into season two.
Yeah, I could be dead wrong about that. You're right. Maybe he will give a threatening speech about the history of the Darksaber. Who knows?
I was only joking. Then as I started to say it, I'm like, well, he did literally go, this is an E-Web repeating blaster.
But you know, you got me there. I might be disagreeing with myself live on air.
But I don't think you're wrong in terms of the spirit. I don't think Favreau's approaching any parts of his story with needing or feeling like he has to explain it. It's just where it is and what he feels are the fun margins. So
yeah. And I don't mean this as a criticism of Rebels, but I do think like Rebels told its own story about its new characters, but also Ezra did just sort of, it was our tour guide up to Obi-Wan and Maul's story. And then that episode ultimately, it's absolutely about Ezra too, but that's about finishing Obi-Wan and Maul's story. And I that's the kind of scene that I'm not sure we're going to get in Mandalorian.
Right. I agree. Yeah. Again, some of these other rumored characters step on through the story and end up in another series. That makes more sense to me. They're in the margins here of this margin playing show, and they'll have their own show later. No questions here, Joseph. I just want to talk about Gina Carano being excited about carrying blasters.
Would she say Thanksgiving that she was at her family's home? And like, I have blasters.
And her sister kind of, I don't want to say her sister was judging her, but just kind of her sister being like, Gina, did you just say blasters? Oh, yeah. And because Gina pushes up her fake nerd glasses in that clip, just going, oh, yeah, blasters. Ah, God, she's winning me over more and more. I was already a fan. I used to watch her fights back in the day. So I just love her enthusiasm for this role. Just love it.
Yeah, yeah. Joyful stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So Favreau did a name drop here as he's he has some friends. I get it. He talked about Guillermo del Toro, taught John and has talked before about the key to being a director of some of these things and creator, is to build miniatures so you can end up taking them to your house later. They go into that. It spins off into the motion capture control, all that kind of stuff. But I got to ask you, of all the Star Wars, things, what miniature would you take home, Joseph Scrimshaw?
Oh man, it's hard not to just say the Falcon. I mean, it's not the maybe a 6 foot long one that we're talking about, but there is a small Falcon miniature, just a small one. That would be lovely to have in my home.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, I love my Y-wings, but I got to tell you, the one I'd probably hope that, I'd clear room in the garage for it, but that one, the famous one of George Lucas in the sweater standing next to the second Death Star and pointing at it, the shot's been around for years, a behind the scenes shot. I want that one. Give me that.
Yeah. Yeah. That one's hard to argue with.
From that, they go into the discussion here, but that there's a spirit in the There was a spirit in the production of New Hope that was about having to make do with what you had, without a doubt. That was a part of what George had to do, what ILM had to do. They were famously in a warehouse over in Van Nuys by the airport. Trust me, folks, drive by that and try to imagine the magic of Star Wars beginning there. It's tough. I used to live over there. So Mando Season 1 did not get a giant budget. And I say this with a little bit of just not insider knowledge, but just having heard some of this during the making of it. There is much to do about how much money they got per episode. And wow, wow, wow. Yeah, look, they're dancing on some Disney dollars. I get it. But they didn't get as much as they had asked for, is what I had been told a few times. If Favreau didn't get, and that was fueling some of the decisions maybe for VO or everything. But now looking at this retrospect, I'm glad because I think they had to connect to that spirit of A New Hope and really start to play with that spirit of making do with what you have, which creates a special kind of realistic magic. It's a ramble from me, Joseph. What do you feel about that?
No, I well said. Well said.
T-shirt available in all sizes.
No, I totally agree. I think there's the reality of the, we get to have fun recreating these shots the way they were done, which is this spirit of, like we were talking about before, there's still power in the old ways and how can we do it on a lower budget? And in fact, I love that they're talking about doing it the old way actually is a little bit more expensive. So we're going to kind of do it in the garage. All that stuff. I think what it comes across in the, I think the final product when people are extremely joyful about making it. Like, I don't think that John Knoll or Hal Hickel are ever like, no, what a boring job. But I think probably we're like, well, we got a bunch of money. We're using our toolbox. We're making the problem go away. That's great. But it feels like to me from what they're saying that this is reconnecting to their youth in that spirit of play and that spirit of adventure of, you know, I'm going to go out with my camera and action figures and figure out how they did some of these shots. And then I'm going to do that. I think you feel that on screen, that spirit of play and fun and in childlike adventure.
Yeah, and absolutely. Yeah. Every one of these people talking in their own way, John Knoll's a pretty quiet guy, it seems, you know, but he's just there and excited and Hal Hickel and just the way he's like, yeah, on Rogue One, we did this. And yeah, I love a lot of what they're saying here. I love all of it, but it's just connecting to some of the parts really, really nicely as a longtime fan. Final thing here, a couple things here as we wrap up the episode. But hey, this kind of ended with another Filoni speech. Not this one, not as publicized, but I really liked what Dave here said. And I noticed, I did a little analysis. He didn't look at Kathy Kennedy as much during the speech. I think he was nervous because I think he was like, is this a job interview? I'm kidding. But Filoni talked about this. He talked about Lucasfilm being built on Star Wars, this company, even after the sale, before the sale, was built on Star Wars. And that kind of allows but also causes the legacy of the franchise to be passed on down to new creators within the company, much like the Jedi. It's passed down from generations to generations. They talked about how the gentleman, gosh, I didn't write his name down, who designed Salacious B. Crumb, comes back to design the cooked Kowalki monkey lizards here.
Yeah, Tony McVeigh.
Tony McVeigh, thank you. Hal Hickel worked on Rogue One. John Knoll, we know his experience. Doug Chang is around. Doug Chang, who's around The Office. All these people. So he feels, and I really correctly, I do believe, this allows for new energy to be put into the Star Wars stories while respecting where it came from, as it also moves the franchise forward. It has all these things that it has to pay homage to, but the responsibility of going forward. I really like what he says to me, because this means the history is important of Star Wars as it is to us fans, but even more important with that is the future. And it has to go forward. Mandalorian, I'd say, Joseph, pretty successful in doing that. Not so much a question as a statement. I concede the floor to you, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is something that we've talked about a decent amount on Force Center. I remember having some really great conversations with Jennifer about it, of the sort of the pain and the hope of losing original contributors to Star Wars, but kind of having the Yoda attitude of, you know, that is the way of the things, that is the way of the Force. So incredibly sad that Peter Mayhew passed on, but so amazing that he handed down everything he knew to Eunice Swadamo. And I feel like it's great to hear Filoni saying these ideas that are in the stories we're telling, we're also living them, because, you know, Tony McVeigh is he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi of Salacious B. Crumb. And, you know, help us, Tony McVeigh. You're our only hope. Come teach us how to make quacking monkey lizards again, and we will pass that knowledge on to the next generation. I think is great on many levels. And I feel like I'm seeing that in this behind the gallery. I feel like every episode, and increasing, we check in with the young woman, Kim Richards, the first AD. And there's little interview snips of her. Like, she comments on, like, yeah, no, it was awesome when Gina Carano just picked up Mando and she did it for real. And there's a brief interview clip with her. And the fact that we're hearing from these kind of old masters sitting around the table in lots of ways, but we are also seeing people like Kim Richards going, like, I have this great feeling of, like, 5 years from now, when there's a breakout hit film that changes all the rules and it's directed by Kim Richards, it'll be awesome to go, like, oh yeah, I remember her from behind the scenes on Mandalorian.
Powerful stuff. I'm glad you mentioned her. My bad for not bringing her up much in these notes on the show so far. Yeah, she's wonderfully just kind of put throughout this series with some great insight and perspective. And I love that. Thanks for bringing her up, because, that is part of the spirit there. And look, sometimes, you know, Ben Burtt not being directly involved with, 7, 8, or 9, and him kind of seemingly, you know, you can twist some of those headlines around, of course, but him kind of like, I don't know why they just didn't bring around. Yeah, that might upset me as a fan, but you know what? Now Matthew Wood, who was his young intern who grew up in Lucasfilm under Ben Burtt's guidance, is the one doing it. That softened the blow for me, who's someone who's a huge Ben Burtt fan, as most Star Wars fans are. So it doesn't mean there's not some challenges in moving it forward and finding new stories to tell and new creators behind it, but that the spirit is there. And I really love that.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And it's fun to get to know some of these behind the scenes people more. Like, David Accord's name first popped to me as a sound person because he does the little noises for Baby, and then noticing, oh, he did that for Rod of the Hutlet too, you know. And seeing that connective thread. And Sarah and I were rewatching some movies this weekend, and I paused because I saw Hal Hickel's name in the credits, and it's like, it's the guy from behind the gallery, you know. And it's great to get to know some of these behind the scenes people and kind of have new faves and new heroes.
Yeah, I can't wait to run into Hal Hickel at a celebration and awkwardly stumble over my words and scare him like I did Swearingen from Kenner. We have some final thoughts coming, but final question, Joseph, I got to ask you this. How much money in real world American dollars or Republic credits, how much money would you pay to see the footage of Werner Herzog giving acting directions to the child?
10,000 actual human dollars, all in advance, for sure. If I had it.
It's got to be somewhere. They're sitting on this gold, because we kind of knew there was something. You know, the story of him saying, "Hey, use the puppet, you cowards." They talked about it. This seemed to be the moment. There's got to be all the things on set. Come on.
Yeah, there's no way there isn't footage of that, right? They gotta release it. The Herzog cut.
Release the Herzog. Final thoughts here on this episode, Joseph. Practical. Look at Mandalorian's practical magics.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was really, really great. These continue to be really interesting in terms of just the actual behind the scenes of how did they do that? Cool to hear, like we didn't mention, you know, we got to hear some lines being of Mando dialogue being delivered by somebody under the helmet, you know, and seeing like, oh, that's really happening on set. Get to see lots of cool stuff. But it's just so great that it is reflecting the spirit of Star Wars while also being this behind the scenes show. And my final thought is that one great shot where the puppeteers are having baby just kind of noodle his head back and forth and kind of drum on the table. Yeah, it just looks like baby is bored between takes. It is beautiful. Just a thing of great beauty.
Glad you brought that up, because there was the moment I saw some people in our Discord chatting about it before I'd even seen the episode. Of Filoni kind of directing the child and then kind of going, oh yeah, that's the stuff, like just being blown away on set. That was beautiful. But Grace and I I mean, our hearts melt every time we see Baby Yoda. She had about tears of joy just seeing Baby Yoda just kind of like, are we ready for the next shot? What are we doing? It's so great. So great. Oh man. Always fun to dive into this series. I got to tell you, fans, you know, Joseph and I, when we said, all right, hey, I guess we'll cover this behind the scenes show weekly. Sounds fun. Some people wanted us to do it. Sure. Hey, it's content. Let's put it out there. Not that we approached it with any kind of cynicism or boredom. We just were like, all right, let's see what happens. Let's see what this series does. This series, each episode continues to reward me, reward us. Joseph, I certainly don't want to speak for you, but it just continues to be a real fun, a rewarding experience. I keep using that word for a reason. And so happy we decided to do this.
Yes. In this case, you have spoken for me. That's going to be my Queel ripoff line. Ken has spoken.
And we have spoken on this episode. We'll see you soon here on Force Center. As always, you can follow us at Force Center Pod, like our Instagram page. We are on YouTube. Subscribe, like, hit the bell, do all those fun things over there, like our Facebook page. Merch is available. Not yet well said shirt, but it might be eventually. tpublic.com/user/ForceCenter. Patreon.com/ForceCenter is where you can support us. Thanks to all of our supporters. We just got new music from the great Tony Thaxton on Star Wars Ranked. And you can follow me at Ked Knapsack, then go to KedKnapsack.com, then go to JosephScrimshaw.com for all of your adventures, sir, correct?
That's right. JosephScrimshaw.com has everything. And then, of course, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Joseph Scrimshaw.
That is it for right now. We understand these are tough, challenging times, but hey, it's challenging for a reason, because you grow through challenges, and Star Wars is there with you. We'll see you next time here on The Mandalorian Report.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.